This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Supporters of a minimum wage hike tried for months to get an amendment on the ballot in Ohio, but ended up falling short. Today on our weekly news review, we're going to talk about what went wrong and how supporters of the measure plan to proceed. Plus, we'll talk about what's causing the American mall death spiral and discuss efforts to reimagine two Greater Cincinnati malls. And heading into the All-Star break, we'll hear what the Reds' chances are to make the playoffs. Joining me now to get us started is Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
It's always great to have you. You know, we talked several times on this program about this effort to get a constitutional amendment on the November ballot to raise Ohio's minimum wage. Walk us through the changes that supporters of this measure wanted to see.
Yeah, so they wanted to see the minimum wage raise for all workers in Ohio to $15 an hour eventually. So under the amendment, most workers would have gone to $12.75 per hour by 2025 and $15 per hour by 2026 if it had passed. It also deals with the subminimum wage. So that's the wage that businesses are able to pay workers who are making gratuities like bartenders and servers. It's lower than the minimum wage for everyone else because oftentimes their wages are largely made up for in tips. So that was another big component of this proposal. It would have brought them to $15 an hour by the end of the decade. But it didn't make the ballot. As you said, the supporters of this constitutional amendment decided at the last minute not to submit the signatures that they had been collecting.
And I know this effort was met with considerable resistance from the state's restaurant industry group. What did that group argue about this whole thing?
They argued that it would put intense amounts of pressure on restaurants and bars to they argued that they wouldn't be able to operate as they are currently because they'd have to raise the wages of what they're currently paying workers, and in turn lobbying groups for restaurants and bars argued that restaurants would have to raise prices and, you know, it may put people out of work because they may not be able to employ as many people just because of the burden of having to go from paying folks. I think the subminimum wage right now is about $5.25 or somewhere around that. They would have had to go up to $15 an hour in pretty short order. So that was a big argument against it. They also did a survey. This was the Ohio Restaurant and Hospitality Alliance. They did a survey a couple weeks before the deadline for signature delivery, which obviously, again, it's kind of a moot point now because this hasn't made the ballot yet, that said that bartenders and servers want to keep their current subminimum wage, and they want to keep making tips because they feel that their tips might be threatened if consumers are kind of bearing the brunt of different charges because their wages have been increased. Now, of course, ORHA has a position in this. You always got to be wary when you're reading a survey from one side, but it was still kind of an interesting survey.
Yeah. Well, and we talked about, you know, this group that was trying to get this on the ballot spent months and months and months collecting signatures. When exactly did they announce they didn't have enough to be on the ballot?
So they announced it on July 3rd in the evening, and July 3rd was the last day to submit petition signatures to make the November 2024 ballot. It's on a different day every year, but it's just about 125 days out from Election Day. They had said as recently as 2 days before that they did have enough signatures. Now, they weren't. What they're telling us is that they had enough signatures to make the ballot, but there are several other requirements that you have to meet. One of those being that to make the ballot in Ohio, you have to get a certain number of signatures from 44 of Ohio's 88 counties. It equals about 1.5% of the election votes in the last governor's race. So it's like a very specific number. Right now, it's about 414,000 signatures. And then also, those specific 1.5% numbers in the 44 different counties. So it's a lot of math. It's very specific numbers. But they said what they were missing was not that 400,000 base number of just getting signatures, they said they were missing that county requirement.
And the state director of this effort, if I understand correctly, made some allegations about problems that their signature collectors had in some rural counties. What did she say happened?
So she has said that they had issues in rural counties where a lot of their signature gatherers were canvassers of color, and they were intimidated and harassed in rural counties. She said that this went so far as law enforcement agencies in a couple of counties actually tailing people to the county line, you know, kind of quote unquote kicking them out of the county. I haven't been able to verify that claim up until this point. I reached out to sheriffs in two counties, Dark County and Preble County, and they both said it was kind of the first they were hearing of this. The Dark County sheriff did tell me, you know, we had a sheriff's deputy interact with a petition gatherer at the Versailles Poultry Days. You know, he was gathering signatures at a tent where the band boosters had paid money to be at this tent. And, you know, someone said, hey, I'm not so sure that I really want someone gathering signatures at my tent. And it's kind of an interesting scenario because sometimes folks who interact with signature gatherers may see them as solicitors, but you technically do have a First Amendment right to circulate a petition. It's a very fundamental right of Americans to circulate petitions. But there are certain scenarios where, you know, for example, at a fair or a festival, even if it's held on public grounds, fair and festival organizers can still say, I don't want folks circulating petitions within my event. So it's kind of an interesting situation. But back to the claim that rural sheriffs, you know, kind of kicked people out of counties, I haven't been able to verify that. You know, these two sheriffs tell me that it didn't happen in their counties. It was the first they were hearing of it. And when I went back to the state director, she wasn't really able to provide more evidence that these things happened. I will say that Raise the Wage Ohio did connect me with two organizers who were out in other counties who did express, they had both been hired by Raise the Wage Ohio pretty recently. They did express that they had, you know, both gone into rural counties and felt a little bit uncomfortable. There were some comments that were made about the fact that they were in Trump country, but, you know, it's tough to draw a line from A to B because it would be breaking the law for a sheriff's deputy or a sheriff to follow someone to the county line for, you know, using their First Amendment right to circulate a petition. And that is what Raise the Wage Ohio is claiming. Hmm.
You also talked with a former Cincinnati City Council candidate who worked on this effort for a while. What did he tell you?
That's right. Evan Holt, he ran for Cincinnati City Council in 2021 and lost. He got involved with Raise the Wage Ohio shortly after his run for Cincinnati City Council because he's worked in the restaurant and bar industry for a long time. And he said it was something he really cared about because he loved that they were doing something about the subminimum wage, which is what I was talking about a little bit earlier, that, you know, servers and bartenders would see a real boost in their base wages. He started in summer 2023. So, I mean, just for timeline there, they'd been gathering signatures for well over a year, nearly 6 months longer than the folks who were gathering signatures with Citizens Not Politicians, the anti-gerrymandering amendment. So Raise the Wage Ohio has been gathering signatures for a long time on this amendment. Evan told me that he worked for them two separate times, and he just felt like it was a really disorganized and mismanaged operation. He said he felt like he was constantly fighting to get basic resources to bring his canvassers out into the community and canvass. He felt like they weren't willing to provide clipboards and campaign buttons and t-shirts. He felt like there was a real crunch for money. And you know, he said he had issues with the regional organizing director, so he stepped away and then she was fired. There was a lot of turnover in the offices. He said even that, you know, for a while he kept being told that they were going to go outside of the greater Cincinnati area to canvass in rural areas, but that never came to fruition. So, you know, flash forward 6 months later and Raise the Wage Ohio says, well, we really struggled in rural counties. But Evan says that when he was there, they were never even out in rural counties gathering signatures.
I know this group has said it's not giving up. What's next for them?
So, because they decided not to submit their signatures on July 3rd, they can still hold on to every signature that they've gathered and continue to gather the supplemental signatures that they need in different counties to hit that 44 county requirement. I've confirmed that with both the Attorney General's office and the Secretary of State's office, because there was some language in their initial petition summary that talks about 2025, and obviously they wouldn't be making the ballot till 2025, so they'd have to change some of those dates. But the Attorney General's office and the Secretary of State's office tell me that's not an issue. They can still keep gathering signatures. And the state director tells me that she wants to submit the signatures by the end of this summer for the 2025 ballot, because all of these signatures that they've gathered, the longer they hold on to them, the more likely that some of them will be invalidated. People move, people register at new addresses, and then that signature, if they signed a petition 6 months before, becomes invalidated. So they want to submit what they have as soon as possible. At least that's what they say. But of course, they had said several times on July 3rd they were going to submit signatures. They said it was going to be at 10 a.m. and then 3 p.m. and then 6 p.m. and then 11:30 p.m. for a very brief amount of time, and then they decided not to submit. So the goalposts have changed before, and I think it's important to note that. But right now, they say they want to submit things by the end of the summer so that they can qualify for the 2025 ballot.
2025 is going to be a very different election year, though, with turnout certainly expected to be much lower than 2024 without a presidential race on the ballot. Don't supporters of constitutional amendments typically try to get measures like this on the ballot when the turnout is expected to be strong?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that was a big reason that Citizens Not Politicians, the anti-gerrymandering amendment, eyed this year. Now, of course, you do see situations like last year, 2023. Normally, that would not be a big turnout year. And it's not like it rivaled a presidential turnout year, but the abortion amendment and the marijuana-initiated statute obviously drew more people to the polls. So these types of big amendments can draw people out to vote. But I mean, I'm sure candidates like Democrat U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown would have loved to have a minimum wage amendment on the ballot, because there are some people who would likely go out because, hey, I'm going to vote on the president, I'm going to vote on whatever, but I know that minimum wage amendment is on the ballot because, and I make minimum wage and I want my wage to go up. So, I mean, this is something that folks that can vote on it, they have a pretty direct impact on their lives. And I think that I think having it in an election year like this is going to guarantee more turnout. But minimum wage amendments, when they make ballots here and elsewhere, generally pass. It's very rare that one won't pass.
Yeah. How successful have they been in other parts of the country?
Yeah, I believe, and Karen, I know my colleague Karen Kassler pulled this data. I believe since 1996, minimum wage raises have made the ballot in states across the country 28 times. And of those 28 times, they've won 26 times. So it's a pretty good track record for the folks who are trying to raise the minimum wage.
Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Thanks so much for your time today, Sarah. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, we'll talk about the American Mall death spiral and the latest plans for two Greater Cincinnati properties. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. If you were a teenager in the 80s or 90s, chances are you spent a lot of time at shopping malls. But the retail world has changed. Malls in our region and across the country have been struggling, and many have closed. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss the latest with Tri-County Mall and Forest Fair Mall here in Greater Cincinnati, and how what's happening here fits into the national landscape, our WCPO9 I-Team reporter, Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And Wall Street Journal reporter, Kate King. Thanks for being here, Kate.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Dan, in the past couple weeks, you've reported on the potential redevelopment of two massive malls in the region. Let's start with Tri-County Mall. What's the latest with that?
Well, the latest is that the developers who wanted to do a billion-dollar makeover are officially out of the picture now. They were foreclosed on earlier this year. Their lender gave them a couple of months to see if they could raise additional money to pay off the debt, essentially buy back the mall. And that deadline passed July 3rd. They weren't able to do it. And so now the lender is talking to another developer, a guy named Stu Lichter, who is well known for redeveloping large commercial real estate sites. And so he's now talking to the lender about a purchase or some kind of a joint venture. And then he'll talk to the city of Springdale about a development agreement after that.
Wow, a $1 billion makeover. Remind us what that plan entailed.
It was basically a large apartment community, I think 2,600 units in all, with a lot of amenities like a 5-acre dog park and walking and hiking trails, bike trails, and also a lot of retail and some outdoor entertainment venues, a couple of stage areas for concerts to happen. It was kind of a live, work, play environment that they were trying to do on this 76-acre site.
This used to be one of the region's premier malls. I mean, I remember when it was kind of neck and neck with Kenwood Town Center in terms of luxury retailers and that sort of thing. What happened to Tri-County Mall?
It succumbed to the forces that have killed the malls all over the country. A lot of people shopping online instead of in person. The anchors, the retail anchors, have had trouble in recent years. Not a good time to be a department store. And so once the anchors go, then the retailers who fed off of those anchors don't want to be there anymore. And some malls have held on longer than others. Tri-County was in decent shape up until the early 2000s. But then, really, in the last 10 years, it faded pretty quickly. And was nearly empty when this Texas duo, the two developers from Texas with that $1 billion makeover plan, when they emerged, the mall was just never going to be a mall again.
Kate, as I understand it, there were about 2,500 malls across the country back in the 1980s. And as of last year, I think there were only about 700. What happened?
Kind of along the lines of what Dan was describing, a lot of malls have just really fallen out of fashion. People aren't spending their afternoons at the malls the way they were back in the 80s and 90s, like you said earlier. And really, the decline of department stores has been a huge problem for malls of profitability and ability to retain it, what they call inline other tenants, and draw people to the mall to shop there. Online shopping certainly played a part. And so a lot of malls have just very slowly declined and gone vacant over many, many years. As you've probably seen in Cincinnati, a lot of lenders don't want to take back malls when the owners default on their mortgages. So it's kind of just a long decline and a real inability to redevelop these malls into something else. It's a very challenging proposition.
Kate, a recent headline for one of your stories was Local Malls Stuck in a Death Spiral Plunge in Value. Are there other factors contributing to this plunge? I mean, most of these malls are still in pretty desirable locations, aren't they?
Malls really do, in many cases, have locations in prime real estate locations. These are, for a long time, malls were built as the economic engines of towns. So for many towns, they were the biggest employer, the biggest taxpayer, and they really were kind of the beating heart of their communities. And so as they decline and people start to say, maybe this shouldn't be a mall anymore, there certainly is interest from other developers and other landowners to want to turn them into something else. But it's a really hard thing to do. And mall values really reached their peak in the late 2016, 2017, timeframe. And then from then really plummeted in value, especially once the pandemic hit. That really accelerated a lot of the challenges that malls have been facing, and their values declined even further. So it's really hard for malls, in some cases, owners to pay their mortgage because their mall is worth much less than it was just 5 or 10 years ago. And so it doesn't really make sense for them, from a financial standpoint, to keep putting money into something that is no longer worth a lot of money.
Kate, what kind of occupancy and foot traffic does the average mall need to survive?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought of it through that lens. I think a lot of people in the mall industry really look at sales per square foot, how much money the tenants are making in their locations. And you really see a bifurcation in the mall industry. There's the top tier malls, which, as you said, are still doing really, really well. They still have a lot of luxury retailers making a lot of money there. These are the malls with the Apple stores and maybe the Tesla dealership and the Chanel outlet. And so they're really doing well. And in some cases, the tenants there are doing sales of $1,000 a square foot or more. So those are the highest performing malls. And then from there, you have some malls that are okay. Maybe they're the only mall in town. And so they're still chugging along and still doing okay, but not thriving by any measure in the way that they were decades ago. And then you have a lot of malls that are really just in this death spiral, this slow, painful decline of losing tenants. Maybe they don't have very few anchor stores left, the department stores, or for example, Sears left a lot of vacant spaces when it went out of business, or went bankrupt several years ago. And so those malls, once you get to a point where your occupancy is maybe below 70 or 80%, it's very hard for malls to turn that around, I'd say.
Dan, here locally, that luxury mall with the Apple store we all know is Kenwood Town Center. Are there other malls? I'm going to get back to your stories, so don't worry about that. But are there other malls locally that you're watching that are kind of in this downward spiral, that are losing tenants and that are kind of on a watch list almost?
Florence is probably the Kenwood is a lot of people think Kenwood is going to be the one that survives, and there'll probably only be one. Florence is interesting because it still has relatively high occupancy rates, but it's facing some big challenges. Macy's recently sought buyers for its two stores at the Florence, a furniture store and an apartment store. And that is probably an indication that these stores are going to be on the list of closures when Macy's gets around to announcing the 150 stores that they plan to close in the next 3 years. So the loss of those two anchors means about 25% of the total leasable space in the Florence Mall. And you know, they do have some national tenants in there. They still have a JCPenney's as an anchor, but the Sears store is closed, and you know, they're going to have a hard time if those Macy's stores close, keeping that mall viable.
Yeah. Kate, do you have any idea how many more malls are expected to close nationwide out of the, 700 or so that are left?
Definitely a couple hundred more at the at minimum, I would think. This is based on estimates from Green Street, which tracks the mall industry and almost every single mall in the country very closely.
Dan, let's talk about Forest Fair Mall. That's another enormous piece of property here locally, and it's certainly not what it used to be. Talk to us about how that mall's fortunes have changed over time.
Well, it was developed as a 90-acre site, 1.9 million square feet of space, and right now the only thing that's occupied there is a Kohl's store, and so it's a dormant mall. Hasn't had viable tenants for probably close to a decade. The owner, who I think bought it something like 10 years ago, has tried a variety of things. For one thing, they tried to sell it. They tried to bring in somebody to make an entertainment use out of it, a hockey rink and other uses. There was a developer out of Texas that wanted to demolish the mall and replace it with four large warehouse industrial spaces, and that plan never caught on. And then just recently, there's a local developer by the name of Rob Smijunas who came in with kind of a mixed use concept. He wants to do large industrial flex buildings for light manufacturing and maybe office users on part of the site. But then he also talks about a 20-acre retail site that would be anchored by a grocery store. And that is a little more palatable to the city of Forest Park, which I think is trying to avoid, you know, large warehouses on this site. But you know, they still have a lot of things to go before they can actually turn dirt there. They have to get a development agreement with Forest Park. They have to get the Butler County Land Bank to agree to transfer a demolition grant to the developer so he can demolish the real estate on the Hamilton County side of this mall. It's a very confusing, I mean, malls are confusing to begin with because they have all these joint agreements between owners and tenants, and a lot of ways for one tenant to block or one owner to block what the other tenants want to do. But in this case, Forest Fair is a mall that's built in two counties, two cities, and three school districts. So there's a whole line of approvals that have to be done before you can ever do anything major like a demolition and redevelopment.
That seems so complicated, those different counties, cities, school districts. I mean, I guess it's always been that way. Has it always been, has that been a factor from the very start in terms of getting anything done or making any changes at that property?
Yeah, I think it's been, I mean, the biggest factor is that nobody wanted to be there. So there were stores that lasted for a while into the early 2000s, but really since 2010, people have been looking for a way out of that mall, not a way in. So that's the biggest factor.
Yeah. Kate, Dan was just talking about what kind of complex animals malls are with all these different agreements between the owners and retailers and, you know, these kind of domino effects that can take place. How does that feed into what's happening with malls across the country? Is that a factor, just the complexity of those relationships in terms of, you know, which malls survive and which don't?
Definitely. And I think it's definitely a huge factor when it comes to the redevelopment of malls, wanting to change malls into something else, whether that's just reconfiguring the mall in a way that the owner believes will help it succeed as an enclosed mall, or demolishing part of it and building apartments or a hotel, or completely tearing it down and changing it into a non-mall use. The tenant agreements that Dan was talking about are a major factor because a lot of department stores have decades-long agreements as part of their agreement to going into and opening up shop in these malls that prevent the owners from doing development on the property, even if it's not a part of the property that's owned by the department store company, but changing it into a non retail use, or building something on the parking lot, for example, that could obstruct even slightly the view of the department store from the road. So these are really ironclad legal agreements that owners need to wait for the department store to leave, or they need to offer money to the department store in order to get them to agree to allow development on the site. And then, of course, you have local opposition to some redevelopment efforts. Dan mentioned a lot of communities really would prefer not to have warehouses in the site where their mall used to be, because warehouses aren't a very dynamic use of the property and there's a lot of trucks coming in and out. But of course, a lot of real estate owners want a warehouse there because as online shopping grows, e-commerce warehouses are in demand and malls are often located right near highways and in areas of town where a warehouse would be really helpful for the online shopping network. And then of course, there's often a really long gauntlet of local approval that you have to go through if you're redeveloping your mall into something else. So all this stuff, it just makes it really complicated for malls to change and be really kind of revitalized in any meaningful way.
I've seen some of these malls that are almost empty or empty, but kind of still kicking a little bit, referred to as zombie malls. Kate, are there reasons that the owners of the malls themselves tend to be reluctant to try to kind of pull the plug on these zombie malls?
Yes, there. In particular, there's some companies that come in and actually buy these really dying malls. And That's because they can get these malls really, really cheap. Sometimes the owners, which are often large publicly traded companies, just walk away from the malls because the malls are worth less than the amount of money they owe on them. And they decide it's not worth throwing good money after what they view as a, you know, a bad property. So they will turn the property back over to the lender, and the lender doesn't want it because a bank doesn't want to run a mall. And so often the lender will sell the property to at a very low price. So there are a few companies around the country that are coming in and buying malls. For example, in Connecticut, there's the Crystal Mall, which was once an extremely vibrant mall and has really been in a bit of a death spiral in recent years. And a company came in and bought it for, I think it was about $9 million. And this company's kind of strategy is to just let the mall carry on for as long as it carries on. So if you buy a mall at $9 million and your tenants are still bringing in $20 million in revenue, you're still kind of making money because you bought the mall at such a low price. So this, of course, sometimes makes the communities a bit upset because they don't want to have a decaying property in their community. And so there's often tension between the owners and the community when this happens.
Dan, you mentioned that the latest plan for Forest Fair Mall that this developer, Rob Smijunas, is trying to get past, it would have some warehouses there, would have a grocery store there. What's the latest plan for Tri-County? I know the big, ambitious plan was what you described with this five-mile dog park and these walking trails and all that. What's being looked at for that property now that those developers from Texas are kind of out of the picture?
They're still looking at apartments as a major use there. It won't be as big as the Artisan Village project, which was the name of the prior project. I think they're thinking more along the lines of 1,300 to maybe 1,500 apartment units, not 2,600. But they've also proposed things like an exhibition hall, like a convention center type facility. They tried to lure some of the trade shows that are usually downtown. But the downtown convention center is going to be remodeled or renovated. So I think Sharonville Convention Center ended up landing those consumer shows, like the Home and Garden Show, for example. So that was one idea they pursued while they were preparing to maybe take over this property. They've talked about restaurants, retail. There's still a dog park in the mix, from what I understand, but they don't have a firm commitment on what they will provide. I think they were hoping to get a development agreement with the city of Springdale before they actually finally committed to the uses that they'll have on that site.
Kate, are there redevelopment trends nationwide when it comes to repurposing these malls, these properties? I mean, it seems like based on their location and some of the other things we've talked about, these properties have a lot of potential.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of interest in redeveloping malls. The easiest thing to do for a mall owner is to redevelop a department store. So if the department store leaves and the owner has the ability, both based on agreements with other tenants as well as buy-in from the community, to change an old Sears into something else. Some popular options right now are subdividing it and putting maybe a big restaurant and a kind of entertainment focused tenant in there, whether it's, you know, golf or bowling or, you know, arcade style stuff. That's really a really popular use for department stores right now. And I think everyone or many people would like to see apartments on mall properties because from the owner's standpoint, if the mall is doing okay, then it's an amenity for apartment residents. And from community standpoints, in many parts of the country, there's a huge shortage of quality housing. So new apartments are, you know, traffic, you know, notwithstanding, often desirable. But it's really hard to do these projects for all the reasons we've mentioned. And also because in recent years, interest rates and the rising cost of construction have made big developments really difficult to finance and just too expensive to pull off at the moment.
Dan, we've worked together a long time. You know I'm an idea person. I'm going to throw this out there. You can share it with the developers. Cat Park.
cat park. You need a lot of space because cats don't want to be near each other. People would pay, I think. Lots of scratching posts. They can deal with some old furniture and still. I'm just throwing it out there. Share that with the guy you're talking to if you feel like it. No pressure.
Do you want some compensation for that if they take
No, I'm in public radio. I'm doing it for the greater good, Dan. But,
oh,
you know,
great.
Thanks for asking. So, Dan, what are the biggest hurdles to making these local development redevelopment projects happen with Tri-County Mall and Forest Fair Mall? There are so many complicated agreements. There are all these jurisdictions to work with.
Yeah.
What's it going to take to try to get these big projects over the finish line?
I think the thing that really was the demise of the Tri-County plan was financing. They had money to buy the mall, but they didn't have money to redevelop it. So that's what really halted that project. It's different for every project, though, really, because, you know, this Forest Fair site is so complicated with all the local governments that have to approve. And, you know, Kohl's has, I think, several years left on their lease, and they have renewals. So they have the ability to block what's going to happen there. In some of the other cases, Eastgate Mall and Northgate Mall, the townships have done master plan designs trying to entice developers to come in, and they're telling them in advance, this is the kind of thing we want to see. And they're signaling to them that, you know, they'd be more friendly to any zoning approvals or economic development subsidies that might be sought if you're willing to do something like these plans that they invented. So far, that hasn't brought any takers. But I think what's going to prevent it is really a developer willing to invest their own money and find the capital to build something.
Yeah. Well, we will stay in touch with you about that. I can't wait to hear how my cat park idea goes over. I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk and Wall Street Journal reporter Kate King. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, as we head into the All-Star break, we'll hear where the Reds stand. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. How about those Reds? As we head into the All-Star break, we're going to talk about where the team stands. Joining me now to break it down is senior baseball writer for The Athletic, C. Trent Rosecrans. Thanks for being here, Trent.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, always great to have you. Catch us up on where the Reds are. They looked so strong sweeping the Yankees in New York, but it hasn't exactly been smooth sailing for the team since then.
Yeah, they struggled against the Tigers, who are actually, I think a lot of this is, there's kind of a reaction to some brand names sometimes. The Tigers are better than what people think they are. And the Yankees are worse than what people think they are. And the Yankees have a great overall record, but right now they've been struggling. It wasn't just that Reds series. So I think when people kind of looked at it and like, oh, you swept the Yankees at Yankee Stadium, like you have a 10-game homestand, you should win all 10. Now, granted, you should probably at least take a game from the Tigers, but they did lose all three, then took 3 of 4 from the Rockies, and that means they took, 6 of 7 on the season, which is pretty good. You know, so you drop one game, and then you have the Miami Marlins coming in. And really, part of this is the National League. There's one good team in the Phillies, a bunch of mediocre teams, and then you have the Rockies and the Marlins.
Hmm.
So that means the Reds are one of the mediocre teams. Or if we want to play like NFL, the parody is working. It's always funny how branding works for things. In the NFL, parody is great, and baseball mediocrity is terrible.
Yeah. So what's working for this team and what isn't? I mean, is there something happening? Was there something happening on the field during that sweep of the Yankees that just hasn't been happening consistently since?
Well, they played the Yankees, who had two hitters,
okay,
which was a big part of it. But, you know, overall, looking at it this season, they've gotten a lot better starting pitching this season. And that has been a big improvement over last year. And also a trend that you like moving forward, because it's mostly younger pitchers. When you talk about Hunter Green, who is now an All-Star, Nick Lodolo and Andrew Abbott, who both had cases to be All-Stars. And then Frankie Montas, who, depending on what happens in the next couple weeks, could either bring a lot of people in return because he could be of a high trade value leading up to the trade deadline on the 30th, or he could stick around. And he's been good. He lost the other day. He lost the one start, but he looked as good as he has. Sometimes that's the thing with baseball is just because you're playing well doesn't mean you're going to win.
Yeah. Does this Reds team still have a chance to make the playoffs?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, okay.
Everybody in the National League is so bad. Again, and
that's the parity.
Parity, yes. Okay. There's so much parity, and with three wild card spots, and really, you know, they're 9 games behind the Brewers in the division. That sounds like a lot, but it's not that much. They're closer to the third playoff spot. And so baseball's, again, a weird sport. They play 162 games for a reason, because it's a lot like blackjack as opposed to poker, where you go in one hand. I kind of think of like football as poker. You know, you build up, and you have big hand, and it's all over. Whereas baseball is blackjack, where you can play 100% the right way. You can go to the sound strategy and still lose, but over time, it should work out. So with that background, there's a thing called run differential, which is simple. It's like how many runs you score versus how many you give up. If you do more, you should be better. Right now, there are only 2 teams in the 5-team National League Central with a positive run differential. That's the first place Brewers and the, well, tied for 4th/5th Reds. Everybody else has given up more runs than they've scored.
Well, that sounds optimistic.
It is optimistic. It's when you look at the, 150 years of professional baseball, over the long, long haul, that will usually play out. That said, it is saying that the Reds are a slightly better than 500 team who are playing, who have a slightly below 500 record. Mm. It doesn't say that they're a juggernaut. It's saying they're moderately unlucky as opposed to a disaster. So it's all kind of weird, and so much of it depends on injuries, and they've had a lot of those, and hopefully you start seeing guys trickling back.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because it seems like injuries were a problem last season. Am I remembering right? How big a problem have they been this season?
They've been a huge problem this year, and a lot of times, you know, injuries happen. A lot of times it's the timing of injuries and having people them kind of like pile up. You know, before the season, a lot of people are like, they have too many shortstops. And then right before the season started, they went out and traded for a shortstop because they only had one left. And so there's a lot of that. And it has been, when you lose guys like Matt McClain, probably for the season, there's a glimmer of hope that he could return, but I would not bet on that. Christian Encarnacion-Strand, I mean, like, and TJ Friedl's been hurt. This is the top of their lineup that they have been missing for all year. That's why if you want to look at positives, you look at the development of the pitching staff. Last year, they were 27th in starters ERA, or 28th, I'm sorry, in starters ERA. This year, they're 13th. And that's because you're seeing the development of Hunter Green, Nick Lodolo, Andrew Ashcraft, the addition of Frankie Montas. Carson Spires has kind of been a nice surprise to help make up for the regression of Graham Ashcraft.
We've been talking about some of the bright spots on this team and how Hunter Green is an all-star. There's, of course, Ellie De La Cruz.
Yeah.
He blasted onto the scene last season. Wasn't super consistent throughout the rest of the year, but do you think he's earned this spot on the all-star team at the ripe old age of 22?
I think he should be starting.
That's my question, too. Why isn't this guy starting?
Well, it's the convoluted baseball loves to get in its own way. Major League Baseball, the capital B baseball as opposed to the lowercase B baseball. I love being on public radio because I make that joke. The thing is there's this convoluted voting system, and you had Mookie Betts and Trey Turner as the two guys. That's the Los Angeles Dodgers Mookie Betts, future Hall of Famer, best in the argument, top 5 players in the game. Trey Turner, who's a great shortstop for the best team in baseball, the Philadelphia Phillies, but he's been hurt a little bit. And so they were the two top vote getters. And at one point it only goes to then who gets between those two. Mookie Betts was hurt, so people voted for Trey Turner at the end because he had just come off the injured list. He hasn't played every day. That's one of the biggest things that Ellie Cruz has done this year. He has played. Yesterday was the first game he did not play at all. It was the second game he did not start. That's a lot. And that is one of, in a team that has been searching for consistency and people to play every day. That's huge. In the game, they call it posting. You know, and it's usually used for pitchers. They post like a horse posts up to the thing. And that gets you the most respect inside a clubhouse. And what's interesting is Elly De La Cruz does all the things that get you attention from elsewhere. Inside the clubhouse, his ability, willingness to post is really, really admired.
Yeah, it's like the perfect attendance award in school. You can't learn if you're not there.
Yeah, and the thing with Elly is we are seeing more consistency. He's having more consistent at-bats. He's striking out less. He's walking more. He's better from each side. He's a switch hitter. So last year, he was really productive left-handed, not productive right-handed. Those are evening out. And so everything he's doing is trending in the right direction, which is fantastic.
Well, and both Elly De La Cruz and Hunter Green have really spent time working on their games, right? Do you think that's made a huge difference for both of them?
Yeah, but I mean, these are two guys who are where they were, where they started, was because they've always done this. These are two guys. Now, you have complete opposite, lives, really. One was signed at 16 out of the Dominican Republic. He was the last guy the Reds signed with some leftover money. That would be Elly De La Cruz. Whereas Hunter Green was in a national name as a high schooler. And the Reds took him second overall in the draft in 2017. They actually do note Sunday have the second overall pick in the draft this year. So you have another impact talent coming in. Again, it's not like football. That impact talent is not immediate. It could be a couple years away, but it also could be closer. We shall see.
Yeah. What do you think being part of the All-Star team will mean for these two players? Do you think it'll boost their confidence and do something for the Reds overall?
I talked to Barry Larkin about this quite a bit the other day, and Barry is a guy who he said it, and I talked to some other players too, and they talked about how it does boost the confidence. But Barry said, you know, with these two guys, it may not matter as much. Because Barry said he was a young player and he always saw himself as a complimentary player. And when he made the All-Star team, he said, oh, no, I can be more than that.
Yeah.
These guys have always had aspirations to be where Barry Larkin ends up in Cooperstown.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with senior baseball writer for The Athletic, C. Trent Rosecrans. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Great to see you. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. If you miss our program live, you can listen to Cincinnati Edition and subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.